You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome back to the Modern Myth Podcast with me, your host Tristan, the Anarchaeologist. Now, today has been a journey of a decade, almost to the day. It seems that when I looked back at previously talking to my guest, it was October 2014. And I was talking to him about a film about cultural heritage in crisis. That was Saving Mez Einach. And I'm joined today by Brent E. Hoffman. And Brent, just would you mind letting our listeners know who you are and tell us a little bit about your kind of background?
Sure. So, again, my name is Brent E. Hoffman. I am a professor at Northwestern University at the Journalism School. And I'm also, of course, a documentary filmmaker. And I'm really passionate about human rights and social justice, and in this case, cultural heritage and where those things all sort of meet up. And like you said, I made this documentary, actually began the process way back in 2009. So it's been even longer than 10 years. It's scary how fast time flies. But yeah, I'm excited to talk about this morning.
So I'm just wondering, in terms of like placing ourselves at that time, way back when, in terms of the reception, I've been looking through all the information on Saving Mez Einach and the kind of accolades it's got, the kind of attention it's got. How have you felt that it's been received? Has there been a time when you've been almost surprised about the impact or the outreach? Or do you feel like the story is so powerful that like you knew it should have had that kind of effect?
If we travel way back to 2009, I read a New York Times story about a Chinese government-owned mining company that was going to set up in an area controlled by the Taliban, and was going to bring in, you know, Chinese workers, sort of really surreal story, bring in these kind of Chinese workers and open pit mine for copper in, you know, in Logar province. Again, this Taliban-controlled area, this dangerous area. And then kind of a footnote to the story was there was some kind of archaeological remains, you know, that may be destroyed, you know, as a result of this open pit mine. Mm-hmm. And that sort of piqued my interest. I'm very interested in China's kind of push into the world. And I, you know, in a rented cobble taxi, traveled to this area, you know, in Logar province to sort of see it for myself. And this sort of started this process of making this documentary that eventually becomes Saving Mez Einach. And what I discover is, you know, this footnote in this New York Times story, this archaeological site is actually this, you know, enormous sprawling, you know, ancient Buddhist city that's on top of an older, you know, Bronze Age site. So there's, you know, 5,000 year plus history here that was all sort of set to be destroyed, basically, you know, blown up in this open pit mining process. And what the film eventually becomes is, you know, documenting the Afghan archaeologists who are, you know, risking their lives to try to save, you know, this incredible heritage, you know, before the looming deadline and everything is exploded, you know, everything's blown up. So it was this very sort of dramatic story. The film, as you say, came out in 2014. It eventually went to Netflix. It, you know, played around the world on, you know, different TV stations and film festivals and won awards. And all that was great. But really the goal was to raise awareness about this incredible site under threat, to really highlight the amazing work of these Afghan archaeologists and, you know, really to stop this from, you know, stop this cultural heritage tragedy from happening. You know, we can get into the details. There have been, you know, good things that have happened. There have been really bad things that have that have happened. But that was the goal, is to save this incredible ancient city.
It's very interesting that if I contrast that to how, for example, archaeology is conducted in the UK or even in the US, a lot of it is what would be called salvage archaeology, in the sense that, you know, developers coming in, archaeologists go kind of first, take off the first couple of layers, try and dig that out. And in the process of this being done, the land is meant to be kind of developed for us in the present. And it's interesting that, you know, contrasting that with how this kind of like site, there was no real intention, from what I understand, from the company coming in who were mining for copper, to really take the time to kind of analyze that. And it kind of makes me feel that like archaeology shouldn't really always be about salvage. It shouldn't always be about trying to mitigate problems, but I think we should be also focusing on preserving that. You know, when you were out there filming stuff, you must have filmed a lot of these different places. How much of that footage is of the site as you saw it back when you were filming? Do you have like a huge archive of like all the details, or how did you go about doing your shots in that respect?
Yeah, that's a great question. And to sort of take a step back to your previous point, mm-hmm. you know, I believe that, you know, the archaeologists were calling it like rescue archaeology mm-hmm. instead of, you know, a normal archaeological dig, where they were, you know, given a really finite amount of time to, in a very kind of reckless way, you know, try to dig as fast as they can and see what's there to try to remove what they could, you know, before this deadline. So you're right. It was this very kind of rushed, chaotic process. And I was, trying to document as many different things. And I think, you know, yeah, you're right. I have an archive of hundreds of different artifacts from, you know, manuscripts that were, you know, some of the oldest manuscripts ever discovered, you know, being pulled from the ground, to, you know, life-size statues of Buddhist statues, to pottery, to coins, to rings, to jewelry, you know, to architecture. So they were, in this very rushed, chaotic way, the, you know, archaeologists were discovering just hundreds of different items. My time at the site was very limited because of danger and security. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think I had sort of these small, like 3 to 4 hour windows where I could, you know, a day where I could sort of document as much as I could. And then I would sort of have to leave before, you know, before it started to get dark, before the site was potentially in danger from a Taliban attack. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was definitely not like business as usual for archaeologists. It was sort of this extreme surreal situation, and again, we were trying to save the site, but at the very least I do have kind of a visual record of, you know, here's what was discovered during that time, and again, here's, you know, sort of the Afghan archaeologist's contribution to this mm-hmm. sort of incredible project.
I think that is something that is so valuable. I think sometimes, and it's an outgrowth of what archaeology has always been, which has always had roots in a kind of colonialism and in kind of imperialism, that, you know, it's always felt that the most knowledgeable or the most best equipped to kind of do archaeology is people from generally the West going out to other countries and analyzing these past civilizations, when I think really what we all should be advocating for is platforming the voices of archaeologists in those countries, in those communities. And I think that is so valuable, because, you know, when I hear what, you know, when I think about what's happened, it's always interesting to me about what was saved and what was left. You know, archaeology is a lot about context. It's a lot about the environment. It's a lot about not just what, but where and when and how. And it's very interesting to me to see, was there kind of a difference between what you felt as a film director, what made an interesting shot, versus what archaeologists were digging up and saying, well, this is actually really, really fundamentally interesting. Did you feel kind of like that you kind of like were kind of going off what they were saying, or did you have a kind of a director cap on as well, you know, in terms of the filming?
Yeah, I feel like there's two questions there that are really great. One is that this idea of of, you know, archaeology, whether it's in documentaries or on, you know, National Geographic, there was a big focus on sort of, you know, Western white male, you know, European white male archaeologists parachuting into some place and discovering, you know, kind of like Christopher Columbus, right? Like, yeah. I've discovered this thing that, you know, local people have known about forever and whatever. There's a long history of kind of that process. And I think it was extremely important. And this project, I'm working on a new film in Yemen, but in both projects, you know, it's the indigenous people that are, I think, and their perspective that are most important. And it's, you know, in Afghanistan, it's the Afghan archaeologists that I feel are the most knowledgeable. They were the ones actually doing the, you know, all of the work. There was a push to not focus on them. And there was also a push, if there was some problem, to quickly blame the Afghan archaeologists, right? Oh, they did something wrong. And it was, you know, it was really important for me not to kind of fall into that trap and to highlight their voices and their contribution. You know, this was really their, to me, this was their project, and they were, you know, the heroes of this, this work, you know. And as, you know, as they're digging, they're getting, you know, text messages from the Taliban saying, you know, if you don't stop this, I'm going to kill you and your family. Right. So imagine,
yeah,
you know, the work is so important to them that they will ignore a text message that basically, you know, says we're going to kill you. And then your other question, I think, is also great. I definitely had my director's hat on sort of in terms of what I thought was significant. But certainly if they were, you know, if they were like, oh, you got to come see this, this is really important, you know, that kind of thing was always in the documentary as well.
What do you think you kind of learned about the process of archaeology while you were out there, while you were filming? What do you think by osmosis kind of was like, oh, okay, this is how it's done? Is there a particular thing that kind of stood out to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. And to take a step back, I'm, you know, I guess this is obvious. I'm not an archaeologist. You know, I come from a journalism and documentary background, though I've taken archaeological, you know, archaeology classes before and sort of introduction archaeology. I think, I don't know if this is the expected answer, but it was true in Afghanistan. Like I was surprised how political the dig was. And I was surprised by this sort of sense of, you know, in the beginning, you asked this question of like, you know, did I expect there to be this big impact of the documentary that, you know, I think, you know, one way I was educated on this is that, you know, archaeologists are motivated by different sort of political ideologies, I guess. And there wasn't, and this surprised me, there wasn't this sense of like, you know, this site should be saved out of principle, or, you know, this site should be saved because it's the right thing to do. I felt people other than the Afghan archaeologists were sort of pulled in different political, you know, directions, whether it's, you know, we want a relationship with China, so we're not going to sort of say what's happening here is wrong. Or this idea of, you know, sites get destroyed all the time, and, you know, there are other, you know, more important sites. You know, there were these sort of politics involved with archaeology that surprised me. I guess naively, maybe I expected more of this sense of, you know, camaraderie that here's this amazing heritage, it's going to be destroyed, let's all come together to save it. That was not the case at all. It was more, I mean, that was the case for the Afghan archaeologists, but any other archaeology group, I think, was pulled in a sort of political direction of, you know, what's our relationship, you know, with the U.S., who was, you know, who had a big foothold and, you know, at the site at the time. What's the relationship with China? Well, yeah, it was disappointing too. Like I felt like my film made a lot of enemies, honestly. You know, because the message of the film didn't sort of fit in their political box of, you know, what they wanted to say.
I mean, this is completely my wheelhouse, Brent. Like, this is, the past is unfortunately political, but that's because we live in like a political world. And I think the thing is that people's relation to the past, which I'm really, really intrigued by, I think tells us a lot about who we are as societies. It's one of those things, because even in the UK, there's been a whole big political kind of cacophony about a tunnel being built through the landscape near Stonehenge. It's divided archaeologists, you know. It's one of these things where, you know, I think instead of, you know, like as an archaeologist, I try to understand things beyond the political, but I understand that it is all part of that. And especially when you're going to a different country, which has different rules and different customs and different cultures and policies and tradition, the important thing is to kind of step back from that. And I think by not taking a stance in this respect, I think that is maybe the better outcome for the documentary. Although, you know, saying that, you know, anybody, you know, you'll know as being making a film is making a perspective, you know, whether it's overt or it's more subtle. And I like to think of the past as also not necessarily being translated into the present through archaeologists just showing the data or saying, oh, this is this. We have to interpret the past. And when we do that, we always put a little bit of ourselves into that. But if we're kind of cozying to that point, that we're actually expressing somewhat of ourselves in that interpretation, we can actually take the time to reflect on that a little better. Because I think it's worse to kind of have this idea that, oh, everything is just so, you know, oh, it was just like that. It was just like that. No, actually there's perspective going on here. And it's interesting to me that like there were so many like kind of competing political interests and pressures on something that, you know, at first glance is simply about preserving cultural heritage, which right. should be on everybody's kind of list. But we'll talk a little bit more about that after this very, very short break. And we're back. You're listening to Modern Myth with me, Tristan. My guest today is Brent E. Hoffman, who's the director of Saving Mes Einek. Now, we've kind of talked a little bit about obviously filming at the time and the kind of pressures around that and the kind of politics involved in that. Obviously Afghanistan has now gone through quite a radical political transformation. I'm just wondering how, you know, after filming and everything, did you keep contact with the archaeologists that you filmed with?
Yes. And I think this is probably the burning question of you know, what's happening now. You know, honestly, this is the nightmare scenario. It's one that I didn't, you know, exactly anticipate, this idea that my country, the United States, would in many ways abandon, you know, Afghanistan. At least that's the way I see it, would abandon this long term partner and friend and turn its back on the country. And it was a sort of a big surprise to everyone that, you know, kind of overnight, the U.S. is no longer going to protect Afghans in Afghanistan. And, you know, the Taliban sort of violently came in, and for the last 3 years have, you know, obviously controlled every aspect of the country. They're in control of Mes Einek. They're the ones now that are going to benefit from this very lucrative deal with the Chinese government, which for obvious reasons they want to, you know, they want this to happen so they can get paid. Yeah, it's been a horrific nightmare for Afghans. The Afghan archaeologists have all tried to, you know, flee the country, some successfully, some it's been extraordinarily difficult to try to get out, as they have like extended family members and grandparents. So it's not just about them leaving. They want to leave with their whole families. But essentially, the Afghan archaeologists, because they worked with the U.S. government, Mes Einek, you know, the World Bank was partially funding the archaeological efforts at Mes Einek. So because of these connections, you know, they're under tremendous threat from the Taliban for religious reasons, too. A lot of the main characters are of a different religion than the Taliban. So there's persecution that happens because of that. So there are sort of multiple reasons why the Taliban want to, you know, either lock up or execute these these heroic Afghan archaeologists. So a big effort of mine has been to try to, you know, to try to help them to get out of the country, which mm-hmm. which is, as you can probably imagine, extraordinarily difficult. Yeah. And now the big news is just in August, the MCC, this Chinese government-owned company, has been given the green light to start mining. They've actually formally started that process of mining. Mae Sinek has not been destroyed yet, but that's sort of the looming thing that, you know, all of us in heritage that are related to this story have, I think, been trying to, you know, stop the site from being destroyed and trying to get the Taliban. I mean, imagine we're trying to get the Taliban yeah. and this Chinese government-owned company to mine in a different way to save the site. I mean, it's the worst possible scenario that could ever happen, probably. Yeah, and that's sort of what we're facing now.
It's sad that it's kind of come to this. I mean, you know, obviously, I can't imagine what it's like to be in that situation in any capacity. I think it's one of those things where it feels as if, you know, some sort of, you know, global connected effort would be useful and beneficial in this way to kind of prevent this kind of almost like, you know, this kind of green lighting. But it's unfortunately, I guess, part of the flow of history. And it's just, I mean, partially fortunate that there has been this, you know, this kind of documentary to kind of at least save a slice of time in which, you know, the attempts were made to do as much as possible. It's interesting to me that your focus continues to be on stories of cultural heritage that are under threat. So as I understand, you're currently working on a documentary about cultural heritage in Yemen. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. So in a very similar vein, I mean, in some ways, it's a shared story between Afghans. So I've been working on this project, at least sort of attempting to get access for at least 5 years, honestly. And to maybe take a little step back again, I am, if my family were here, you know, my young children were a part of this conversation, I think they would also sort of notice I have this, I sometimes describe it as this sort of dysfunction in my brain, maybe, where I'm very attracted to stories where, you know, there's a human rights story or this mm-hmm. cultural heritage at risk story that is in many ways impossible to tell, or I'm told from people yeah. involved that it's an impossible story. So in many ways, the Mae Sinek story was an impossible story. No one wanted to talk about this. No one wanted to be on camera. Access to the site was extraordinarily difficult. You know, the list sort of goes on and on. And Yemen is that same way. Like, just to get a visa to Yemen took me, you know, almost a year, if you can believe it. Mm-hmm. And then the visa is just like the starting point to getting many different levels of access. Yemen is an extraordinarily sort of complicated and divided country. But my plan was to tell a story, again, like the Mae Sinek story, of Yemeni people trying to save cultural heritage in different parts of the country during an active, you know, war, right? So yeah. Yemen has been essentially in sort of a civil war for, you know, over 10 years. And if you follow the news, you know, that continues, and the bombing, you know, that's happening in Yemen continues, you know, just last week, it's being sort of actively bombed. So the idea was, again, in this sort of impossible story, but this very compelling story, try to get access to Yemen, you know, and try to highlight these individuals that are, again, risking their life to try to save, you know, heritage while, you know, their world is being sort of, you know, actively bombed, right? Sort of, I think this really sort of compelling story. In Saving Mae Sinek, I always felt really bad that there weren't women's, you know, subjects in the film. Like, it's a very male film, and part of that is, you know, just simply the Afghan archaeologists working at Mae Sinek were all male, and it was a cultural thing. And for a man to interview a woman, like especially a foreign man to interview a woman in any way in Afghanistan, is a very tricky, you know, cultural process that's very, very difficult. So in this new film in Yemen, I'm really trying to focus on, you know, women, Yemenis, you know, cultural heritage specialists and archaeologists, you know, again, trying to save heritage. And Yemen, to, you know, it's a relatively small country, has just this, you know, treasure trove of history and sort of importance in the world. It has 5 UNESCO World Heritage Sites, all of which are under threat from war or from climate change. You know, something we haven't talked about yet is the way climate is also, you know, threatening every part of heritage, really. Looting is happening at Mae Sinai. Looting is happening in Yemen. So there's kind of this perfect storm of all of these threats happening in Yemen, in some of the most incredible, you know, heritage sites that, you know, especially in the United States, you know, that really no one knows about. So much like Afghanistan, you know, the stereotypes, the negative stereotypes in the U.S. around Yemen are all about, you know, war and famine, and really they know nothing about this rich heritage that is, you know, that is disappearing, and that people are fighting, Yemeni people are fighting to try to preserve.
I think that is the human story that's at the heart of these kind of things. And I think, you know, it's very easy for people to, you know, disengage themselves. I mean, we kind of do live in a society where we almost have this information overload, and it's difficult to kind of contend with all the conflict going around the world, that really these are things impacting people's daily lives, and that in those same situations, we may also find ourselves, were we in the middle of a conflict, attempting to make the best of the situation and preserve heritage in our own areas as well. And I think that joining that line is, I think, the way to kind of get to people, because I think ultimately, you know, providing a kind of human face to these kind of situations sometimes is the panacea to, you know, the kind of relentless scrolling or the relentless news feed where, you know, numbers are chucked around and you almost get desensitized to things like, you know, the consequences of war and conflict. I'm really glad you brought up climate change, because within archaeology as a sector, like, climate change is talked about quite a lot. There are some groups that kind of like focus on it. There, I know for many of the associations, there's kind of like impact assessments going on and everything. But I think in the general population, there's a kind of disconnect I find sometimes between what people feel heritage and history is about and what people are, you know, what the profession or even community groups are doing. And what I really liked when I was reading about the work you do is coming back to what you're saying about your drive to kind of find out about things that are, you're told are impossible. You know, finding those oft forgotten voices is actually what like modern archaeology really is, because for so long history has been about, you know, kings and royalty and large battles and everything. But nowadays, archaeologists are trying to find the small pieces of human daily life, you know, the people who lived alongside all these warriors, these kings, these queens, these like very important people. Like, how can we find more about the people who live daily? So for me, there's that, you know, that connection of finding the people who don't usually get talked about, or the stories that don't usually get talked about, and the way that we actually practice archaeology and trying to dig up the stories that are not really spoken about properly. Do you see that connection when I speak about it?
I do, yeah. And I think you make so many great points. I'd love to respond to.
Please.
I totally agree that in many ways, yeah, you know, history is told by, you know, the victors of war and the, you know, like you say, the sort of kings and the queens and the nobility and the lives of the everyday people like us, you know, like all of us sort of get lost in that sort of telling, that sort of vein of telling a story. And in many ways, you know, again, when you in Masonic, the Afghan people in this Yemen project, these Yemeni people that live in the areas, like they're the ones that really have that connection to the past, right? In some way, telling their story and connecting it to the story in the past, I think is much more telling about the area and the region than, you know, again, this sort of bullet point of you know, of war and politics and things like that. This sort of everyday story and the indigenous people's connection to that history, right? And the way the history sort of continues. Mm-hmm. That's something that's also amazing in Yemen is you have, you know, for example, like the mud brick architecture that's really incredible, right? You have it's sort of this passed on tradition that you know, modern Yemeni people actually have this kind of incredible connection to, you know, thousands of years of history and this passed on heritage. The other thing that you said that I think is really great is, you know, especially in the West, but especially in the United States, there is this disconnect now between or almost this push to be more insular, right? Like, you know, we're Americans. We only care about what's happening in America. This is a faraway story. It's Afghanistan. It's Yemen. We have our own problems. You know, we no longer care about the rest of the world. There is this sort of this way of thinking now that's very prevalent in, especially in the United States. And in both films, in the Masonic film and the new Yemen project, you know, I don't want to just sort of accept that there are these audiences that are lost to us. You know, I wanted to, you know, tell stories to the widest possible audience. And as you mentioned, you know, connecting to people on an emotional level, on a personal, smaller human level in, you know, in the Saving Masonic story, it's Kadir, the Afghan archaeologist who, you know, it's through his emotion and his love of his own country's heritage that I hope is sort of infectious and that audiences, when they watch, can feel, you know, empathy and a connection with him. And it's through that feel a connection to Afghanistan and see their own story in a way in, you know, reflected in, you know, in Kadir's story. And that's something I'm trying with the Yemen project too, to, you know, again, these smaller personal stories of devotion to cultural heritage, almost as these kind of windows for people in, you know, other countries like the United States to find common themes and connect emotionally, you know. And I think documentary as a visual medium, as a storytelling medium, you know, I'm biased, but I believe it has the strongest potential to do that, to connect, you know, on an emotional level with an audience so that through feeling something, you know, hopefully they come to care about these stories that, again, you know, in a bigger sense, a lot of the world is very sadly turning away from.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And in spirit of taking a step back, since, you know, that's what we're in that vibe right now. I think it's really important for us to also think about when you're saying about the widest audience possible. I'm kind of interested in, at the time, the reception to the film Saving Masonic in Afghanistan, and whether, you know, as an American coming to these countries, having a, you know, your kind of background is filming for, or in your mind, your experience of documentary films is, you know, Western. Like, is there something that you do to kind of translate it to a broader audience that's different from if you made a documentary purely with an American or Western audience in mind?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's complicated. I think there's one, you know, which is everything is complicated, I guess. And I certainly make mistakes. So I will not say I've perfected some method to do this. I certainly haven't. But I think one thing, again, that I think I sort of alluded to this before, you know, there's a push to reach American audiences by like placing an American in an important part of the story, right? And that's something I really hate and I'm really against. So in Saving Masonic, I am not a character. Like it's not my story of coming to Afghanistan and meeting people, right? But I think there is this push, especially in the United States, to like have American, you know, white male American as the central character, right? And and it's through their perspective that you reach the American audience. And I really, you know, like I said, I hate that and try to push back against that. So I still want to reach an American audience, but as you say, because, you know, I don't want to make this as much as I can, you know, everything is subjective, of course, but as much as I can, I don't want to make this like the white male American story. I want to try to tap in and give voice to local people. And as much as I can, I want the films to be their story. Right. So that means I really have to collaborate with local people, with local producers. And for both films, I'm working with a local producer to really make sure I do that justice. And again, you know, not only is there not white male American main subject, but I want to make sure like culturally, this is sort of an accurate representation of their story, right? Of the Afghan person or Yemeni person. You know, with that said, that is not a format, I think, that is easily digestible for a Western audience, right? Because, you know, you have to read subtitles, you know, it is a person that's culturally different than you. Mm-hmm. So there is some kind of heavy lifting, I guess, getting this to an audience. But that is, that's been my goal to highlight these indigenous voices and to really, as much as I can, try to make it their story and then try to get that story to the widest possible audience I can. And it's been difficult, but you know, there's, like you said, there's been some success with Saving Mae Sinek of trying to do just that.
And so the new film, has it got a title yet, or is it all tentative? And when would we expect to be seeing that new film that you've got currently in production?
Yeah, so it is the tentative title is the very tentative title is Saving the Cultural Heritage of Yemen, and I'm looking at many different cities so far. So it'll probably be, again, a feature-length film, but where we're sort of traveling to different locations, you know, highlighting different voices from, you know, Houthi-controlled areas in the north, like Sanya, which is one of the longest inhabited, you know, cities in the world, to Marib, that has this incredible Queen of Sheba history and these sort of incredible temples devoted to her, to cities like Taz that are kind of caught in the middle, that are literally split down the center of the city, you know, where the civil war is like happening right in the middle. So you have castles that have been partially bombed and libraries that have been firebombed. And you have people kind of caught in the crosshairs doing heritage work. I'm, you know, hoping that the film will be completed next year in 2025, but it's a, you know, because I'm attracted to difficult stories that have lots of difficult aspects to them, it's been a slow process, but one that I'm devoted to.
No, it's very worthwhile. You know, I grew up in Northern Ireland post the Good Friday Agreement, which was the kind of marked ceasefire agreement there. And, you know, even with that, I only realized when I moved to Scotland that a lot of my childhood was very much informed by the Troubles, even in peacetime. And, you know, growing up in a country that's kind of like just post-conflict, you kind of like, it makes me feel a connection somewhat to people undergoing that, because even though I don't understand necessarily the ins and outs of these kind of situations, I think there is this kind of sense of anxiety or fear or concern, you know, that I think I understand the draw that you have. You know, I maybe in a different life I would be doing something the same, you know, because I think these stories that are, you know, the difficult ones, I think that's all the more reason for them to be platformed, because at the end of the day, you know, life overall, without getting too philosophical about this, it's difficult, you know, and we can kind of like sometimes sit in our wee bubbles. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that somebody needs to go out and experience conflict, but we need to always be ready to take like a trip out of our comfort zone to kind of understand and yes. empathize more with people. Just kind of finally, you know, I know that you are currently a professor, is it? At Medill? Yeah, Northwestern. And what advice do you give to students who are kind of trying to pursue a similar kind of vein of documentary that you've done? What is it that you impart? What wisdom, you know, not wanting your whole syllabus, don't worry, I send the check in the mail, but like, what's the kind of, what advice do you give to people who are wanting to take on that challenge?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think, you know, I'd love to kind of respond to your last point. I think it's totally related to this advice I would give students. I think this idea of, you know, there are these difficult stories like we've been talking about that are out in the world. And especially in my sort of corner of the profession in journalism, you know, I would argue you can't be told like, you know, this story is too difficult, so don't tell it, right? Like you can't, you sort of can't tell a journalist, you know, cover this easy story and don't cover this other story because, you know, there are too many barriers to telling the story. Like, I mean, imagine if journalists accepted that, you know, we would have this, you know, sort of teeny tiny perspective on what's happening because there's so many, you know, difficult stories that, you know, that the world needs to know about. And I think that's advice I would give to students that, you know, this is our job to not turn away from these difficult stories that, you know, you have what we've been talking about, these, you know, people in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. people in Yemen that are, you know, sort of suffering from this sort of oppression or from war and are doing this kind of incredible heroic work that it's really our job to highlight. You know, I really try to impress upon students or teach my students that, you know, often the first step in trying to tell a story is getting a door sort of slammed in your face and having people say, you know, no, you can't do this. And you have to persevere sort of beyond that. And, you know, there may be many, many more doors that are slammed in your face, but you have to persevere. And it's really, you know, these human stories from our own backyards or from across the globe that it's worth all of this, these sort of difficult aspects, you know, in order to tell these incredible stories. So it's not easy, but I think the rewards of doing this work are pretty great. And being able to tell these stories and connect with these incredible people is pretty, you know, it's pretty amazing.
Definitely. And if people are interested in either watching Saving Mez Einak or seeing any of the work that you've done, where's the best way to kind of get more information on that?
Yes, good question. So Googling my name will bring up my university page where it has my contact information on it. But for Saving Mez Einak, savingmezeinak.com is a great place to start. And there are many ways, you know, it pretty much any ways to stream the film that exist out there. You can stream Saving Mez Einak, and you can also connect with me through that website as well.
Great. Thank you very, very much for your time today, Brent.
Great. Thank you. This has been really wonderful. Thank you so much. Told you what you wanna hear. Why can't you see that the truth will set you free? Expose this modern myth with me. A myth. Modern myth. Modern myth. Modern myth. It's a modern myth.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.